Welcome back to another episode of Carpooling with Adam. I'm a little later in the week, so those of you who've been on the edge of your seat waiting for the episode to drop, sorry. I'm getting to it a little later this week. And I just realized I jumped way too far ahead in the book, so I apologize. Oh, wait. No, I didn't. I already did chapter 7. So, yeah, chapter 8 is correct. Okay, the only thing faulty is my memory. Okay. Chapter 8, Keeping Your Eye on the Job. So here's the big idea covered in this chapter. The day a product becomes real and hits the market, everything changes for managers. There's so much pressure to grow that it's possible to lose sight of why customers hired you in the first place. Even great companies can veer off course in nailing the job for their customers and focus on nailing a job for themselves. In our research and experience, that happens because companies fall into believing three fallacies about the data they generate about their products. The fallacy of active versus passive data, the fallacy of surface growth, and the fallacy of conforming data. This should be a good one. I've been talking with a friend recently about these very things. We've always enjoyed talking about, doing the post-mortem analysis of, well, not post-mortem for some, for the companies that fail. Why'd they fail? Maybe what decisions led to that? We get the benefit of Monday morning quarterbacking it. And then why are companies succeeding where others seem to not to, right? What are they maybe doing right and what decisions did they make? Which is very interesting because everyone is faced with a lot of decisions and everyone makes good and bad ones. So I think the end result of our conversations is not here. We're going to hit on the secret formula that we're going to make all the right decisions along the way. That's not the case, but it does make for good discussion and analysis to try and learn from other people and other situations out there. So let's jump right to, we'll see. Was there anything in the thing that I wanted to talk about? Yeah, so much pressure to grow that it's possible to lose sight of why customers hired you in the first place. Very true. And where does that pressure to grow come from? Different places, right? If you're a publicly traded company, often they'll say it's from shareholders or from the market. Sometimes it's maybe a founder or executive has an agenda that they're in love with and trying to, let's call it a vision, and they're trying to see that come to fruition. But all of a sudden, things become a bigger deal, and there's a lot more involved maybe in the day-to-day operations of a business. So I can totally get why it's easy to lose sight of your foundations and your start and how you doing the job the customers hired you to do in the first place, and maybe even lose sight of how the job they've hired you to do is evolving and changing, and losing sight of what changes and evolution you need to make and further innovations you need to make to continue to support them and be a viable option in the market and deliver value. All those things can be very easy to lose sight of, and obviously a lot of people do. And so I hope in the takeaways he mentions these fallacies, and then we can elaborate a little more on those. And then this last one, he talks about the origin story and how the founders or an entrepreneur found some important job that doesn't have an existing satisfactory solution, and they found a creative way to solve it, right? That's how most of them start out. But then as a company starts to grow and some would say mature, it's very common to lose that focus. And some that's not to say that's necessarily a bad thing. I guess losing focus would be seen as a bad thing, but losing focus on the right thing, but you know, things can change and markets can shift dramatically. And when I say markets, I'm not talking stock markets or investment markets. I'm talking business company markets that the company operates in, right? The ecosystem or the economy or whatever. A little more broad than stock markets. Things can change, and it may take some major adjustments or major adaptations to be made. So just changing focus on its own is not bad, but losing focus, now you're starting to get into troubled waters. And then, like I said, if you can't learn and adapt effectively, then you're in even worse situation. And this isn't to pass judgment or say that people's intentions turn evil once the company is growing and maturing, because most of them have the best intentions, and are relying heavily on a century or so of business practice or marketing strategies, right? And then they start to, he says, this is key where it kind of makes the shift and kind of gives you the indicators. Companies start to act as if their business is defined by the products and services they sell instead of the jobs that they solve. I think I mentioned earlier on, he gives the example of drills. And if you think you're selling quarter-inch drills, instead of taking the different spin on it of you solve making quarter-inch holes, it's a different focus, right? But it's easy to lose that focus because there's probably so much involved in making quarter-inch drills, and there's a lot involved in sorting that out and selling it and shipping it and how do you deal with returns and product support issues and all. You know, it gets big real fast. So I can see how it's easy to lose the right focus. Okay, so he does cover the fallacies here in the takeaways. Good. There's a lot of things that can cause this drift, as he calls it, to happen. Drift away from true north of the customer's job. And then he talks about you falling prey to the three fallacies of innovation. And I like that he uses the tendency of managers. That's a very general term. And I think it can apply generally. It can apply to frontline managers. It can apply to middle managers. It can apply to executives or to people at the very top even, right? Everyone's susceptible to this. So the first one he mentioned was active data versus passive data. What does that mean? So what people start to do is the characteristics and the data that you're gathering in the middle as you try to understand the rich complexity of the job is, he calls, passive data. Well, then growing companies start to generate a bunch of operations-related data or active data, right? So now you have actual customers and actual information and actual sales and all of the data that's actually being generated by the operation of the business day-to-day is now at your disposal. And because it's active, I can see how it's more alluring, right? It's real. It's active. It's happening now. And I know what we sold so many units of product X and brought in this much revenue, which resulted in this much of a profit. That data is very alluring and very tempting, right? Understandably so. And then you feel like real life, real world decisions. And you can start to view the passive data as pie in the sky, hidden in the clouds, you know, more ethereal type things, and lose sight of some things. So active data, he's kind of saying the same thing I was trying to get at is active data seems to have objectivity and rigor, but it tends to organize itself around products and customer characteristics rather than jobs to be done, right? I work in with healthcare data, and so it's been interesting over the years as I've gone to different healthcare providers. I used to ask them questions, and their reactions were always mixed. But I would ask them things like, "Oh, well, do you know which customers are most profitable to you?" And sometimes they knew, sometimes they didn't. Sometimes they said, "Yeah, but it doesn't matter because most of them are from from Medicare, and which pays the worst out of all of them, and so all the good paying health plans tend to subsidize those ones. But that's my major population, right?" So they just kind of like, "Yeah, whatever. I have that detail, but what am I going to do with it?" Versus another provider told me, I don't care. I don't even look at that stuff. I'm just happy to still have the lights on and be able to pay my employees and earn a living, right?" And that was the extent of his business analysis and interest. And so he felt like that worked. He wasn't interested in specifics, about his customers and whatnot. And I don't have their financials to know, or even try and conjecture which one's got a better, more winning philosophy. Yeah, why even go there? But anyways, so that's the one of active versus passive data. It's going to get harder and harder to hold on to the passive data unless you make that effort from the beginning and hang on to it. The second fallacy was surface growth. So customers start making big investments in customer relationships. Then you want to sell additional products to the same customers, and you can start expanding and solving a broader set of their jobs, right? This is called surface growth, as opposed to staying focused on solving the core job better. Ooh, interesting. I've definitely seen that. We need to broaden our footprint in our industry, right? You hear phrases like that. You hear, what's some other ones? Or we can tap into this new adjacent market, right? Different things like that is surface growth. And you start chasing those things, well, naturally your focus is going to shift away from your core job and doing that better and better and better. It would be interesting to see it, and I think what makes this hard is that shift away from your core job isn't necessarily going to be visible or noticeable, right? That's going to be hard to quantify, to say, "Oh, well, because we spent $5 million on this new product or this new market space and, expanding, broadening our reach, that means we lost $7 million that we could have got by making our core job better." Those numbers are going to be hard to come up with. And maybe somebody can come up with a number, but how reliable is that? I don't know. I think that's going to be a little too challenging to do. But it is interesting that it's surface growth, and so what? I guess you have to make that decision, right? And I'm sure a lot of companies do. Of, well, if we chase these three adjacent markets, we will triple our revenue. Maybe. Are you leaving stuff on the table? Or maybe that doesn't matter, right? Or maybe you don't see that there's any money being left on the table by doing so. It's only just growth. It's bigger. It's better, right? I think that sounds good superficially and looks good on paper. I don't know that it always pans out like that. I think there is a cost and there is a price from not staying focused on solving your core job better. There is a cost. It's going to be hard to quantify or qualify, and therefore it may not be easy to see whether or not something's worth it. And the decisions start to get muddier, and I think it gets harder and things get more nuanced and trickier. So I get why people fall in love with the surface growth and chase that. But I do think there is a cost and there's a price, and there's potentially a danger if with doing that. You're sort of losing focus on something that you've invested so much in and learning so much about and having such a good comprehensive understanding, like we've talked to from previous chapters, and now going into sort of starting over in something that you don't have. If it's new to you, you're not going to have the same level of understanding, maybe more than the next guy if it's something already in your space and your world, but still you are not starting out from the same point, right, of where your product maturity is on your core job to be done. So I think you have to have careful consideration. And are you going to make the same investment? I think that's the other trap. So we chase this adjacent product or this adjacent market or adjacent opportunity or whatever out there. Shoot, I just lost my train of thought because this light is getting kind of warm, and that's weird. So sorry, it threw me off. Where's it going? I don't know. Maybe it'll come back. Oh, was I talking about, are you going to make the same level of investment of effort? Yeah. Probably not, because you're going to not know where that line is. Because without making the investment, you're not going to know where does our current line end and this new one begin. And those lines are going to get blurry and fuzzy. But anyway, I've talked about that one enough. Okay, the last one, the fallacy of conforming data. So managers start to focus on generating data that conform pre-existing business models. Definitely have seen this, especially when people are stumbling in the dark about what data to focus on. Everyone's jumping on this bandwagon nowadays, right, of big data and AI and analytics and predictive models and things. And some of those are even fading into the background at this point. But so there's this bigger emphasis on data, but then they tend to view it from the lens of their current understanding, which what's the fallacy there, right? Then you lose out on seeing new opportunities and new possible innovations because you're so focused on making all this data out there conform to your current narrative that you're going to miss stuff. All right. And then he concludes the takeaways by saying the awareness of these fallacies is the first step toward preventing them from taking over innovation in a company. But doing so on an ongoing basis requires constant vigilance and intervention. You can see why people chase these fallacies and get lost in them forever, right? The vigilance and intervention, who's keeping that in check? Who's driving that? As soon as there's the next shiny new thing, everyone wants to chase that, right? And there's not a lot of people willing to stand there and go, oh, wait a minute, because then you're seen as an obstructionist, right? Well, we've got a great opportunity here, you just want to stay stuck in the status quo? How innovative is that, right? You get that kind of pushback. But I like how he points out, if you're not careful, these fallacies will take over innovation in a company. It doesn't matter if your marketing still says you're an innovative company. If you've gotten lost down the paths of these fallacies, you're closing the door on more innovations than you're opening them to, right? So I think this is an important warning. And I don't think there's a role in the modern business world, at least not a commonly known or accepted one, that it's someone's job to be vigilant and do the interventions where necessary. I think to my knowledge and breadth and understanding, that is non-existent. So if somebody's actually seen somebody play that role, that would be awesome. I think maybe I've heard of founders who do this. They'll say, wait a minute, you know, I think we're kind of losing sight of things here. Let's get back to some basics or fundamentals that I think we're walking away from that are key and are our foundation. Certainly this gets lost, when those founders are then bought out, right? They make an exit. How often do those kinds of things transfer over? I would almost never, if ever, right? So anyways, that's just my thoughts and observations on this. So questions for leaders. So good. I think these questions are important in supporting you in that vigilance and intervention, right? So his first one is, how connected are your innovation efforts to the core jobs your company has How connected are your innovation efforts to the core jobs your company was started to solve? How do your innovations align with those? Yeah. And if they don't, you need to look into some things. I think that's a good question to ask to help you remain vigilant. How would your people characterize the fundamental business you're in? Ooh, good point. Now that things have expanded beyond the founders and you've got more people involved, how good a handle do they have on the fundamental business you're in, right? And how would they describe it, right? Do they describe it in terms of solving an important job in customers' lives? Or most likely, they're going to talk about it in terms of products and services you offer, right? And how do you do that? That's got to be a challenge to figure that out. Of how are you going to do that? How are you going to transfer that knowledge or that understanding? And is it just a knowledge and understanding transfer, right? Is that really what's involved there? Maybe it's more involved and in depth than that, probably. But you've got to do that in order to maintain your vigilance and do the right interventions. What data drives your innovation and investment decisions? How closely connected is this data to your customers' jobs? Again, continuing to bring your thoughts and things back to that connection, that link. What do you do if you've severed that link? That's a good question. But look at, how are we deciding what we're going to innovate and what we're going to invest in? Man, that's a hard thing for people to master or get a handle on. I see a lot of people get stuck or fall flat on their face with this one. And does that data connect? Is it closely connected to your customers' jobs, or is it so active or so operationalized that it's disconnected, right? Because at some point, all of that some level will be disconnected from these core things. It's just strictly operational data and is going to get further and further away if you let it from your actual core. And then ask, are you falling prey to the fallacy of surface growth? That is, are you overly focused on driving growth through selling new products to existing customers without an understanding of the progress customers are trying to make in their lives? Ooh. Elaborating too much on this one's going to get me in trouble. I'm going to have to really bite my tongue. But let's just say I've seen this for a long time. And, some people call it shiny new ball syndrome. I refer to it that way. Chances are your customers are trying to make progress. Are you helping them out progression? Are you progressing with them? Or you figure, well, we've solved that need. We're moving on to something else. Good things to reflect on. What data is gathered, is the next question, and presented to make important innovation and investment decisions? What mechanisms do you have in place to ensure that this data reveals what you need to see rather than what is comforting to believe? This one's interesting. It's one of the reasons I like being involved with data in my current and previous roles, because I like to see, what does the data tell me? Right? Let the data tell its story. I don't want to go to the data looking for a story and hoping to find and digging and trying to manipulate the data so it tells me the story I want. I would much rather poke around in the data and say, okay, what does it tell? What's the data tell me? What is actual factual here and what is not? And that makes some people uncomfortable, right? Because if they've been acting without the actual information or the hard data, there's a lot of assumptions that have gone into play, and some of those assumptions are going to be false. The data is going to tell a different story, but that's why I like it. There was a time where I was heavily involved directly with troubleshooting product support issues of new products and features and whatnot. And there were so many components and moving pieces. My favorite thing to do, although this was the least favorite thing for customers to give me access to do, understandably, was, can I just look at the database? I don't want to go back and forth about what we think happened with the data coming in and what we how we think it was stored and how we think the application responded to it. We can do that for hours. I just want to look at, here's what data made it in. Okay, so now we know we have a problem between you sending the data to us and what's getting into the system and actually being stored. Right? And then you can start working back from either of those ends. Even better if you can say, okay, here's what we log that you sent us. Oh, well, that's not what we think we sent. Now you've just narrowed down where the issue is, right? Instead of the full thread, the full stream of things, it's in this segment right here. Let's look there. Let's see what happens. All right. So that's what I love to just, can I just have access to your database and I'll just run some simple select statements. And it's going to tell me a whole bunch of story of the story and give me a whole lot of clues right up front so we don't have to make assumptions and stumble around so much trying to figure out what's going on. But figuring out what is that data, how do you get access to it, and then how do you interpret it, that's a whole other ballgame, right? That entire industries and markets are still trying to sort out, so... and then do you have things in place to make sure that's the data you're getting access to and that's the data you're seeing? And what information do we want to know, regardless of how uncomfortable it makes us, regardless of whether it contradicts the current narrative? I've been in that spot too. I find data that's like, wait, that's not the story we're telling, or that's not the story I'm getting, or that doesn't necessarily fit the narrative I'm being told. So let's look at it and then I can understand how those incorrect narratives are happening, but then also formulate what the actual narrative is, something more solid to go on, rather than what's comforting to believe. I'm okay being uncomfortable with the data. I'm not okay with all kinds of discomfort, just disclaimer there, but discomfort with the data I'm seeing, I'm okay with that. I love that. Now, here's an investigative opportunity. A top opportunity for me to learn, opportunity for me to understand things better. That part I like. All right. How are you ensuring that your customer's job to be done has a voice in your decision-making and resource allocation activities? That's a really good one. Is your organization and team structured in a way that facilitates that, right? That's a good question. And Do you, so some people will say, well, we do voice of customer, so boom, got it nailed. No, not necessarily. The name voice of customer sounds like it's the right thing, but often it's not, because it's not focused on the job to be done. The job you're trying to solve has all these other focuses that we've talked about from this chapter. So just having it, doesn't necessarily assure anything. And decision making and resource allocations. All right, well, if we had this information, would we make a different decision? Ask those questions, right? Okay, are we maybe allocating too many... excuse me. Now that we've looked at things, whoa, we're putting a lot of money over here that's not helping with this. So do we need to restructure? Do we need to change our process, right? What changes will enable us? What interventions, to go back to one of the previous ones, will help us get back on track and back in the space we want to be? We've obviously gone astray. So how do we correct it, right? And whether that's resources in terms of people or money or time, could be any or all, right? All right. Well, that's it for the questions and for the chapter takeaways. Again, very good discussion. I love doing this and going through this. Hopefully it's maybe got you to think about some things differently like it does me, and maybe reconsider some things and help you be more vigilant. And hopefully you can make the right interventions in the right areas. I have a very good idea of how daunting that can be, especially in a large organization. It's extremely daunting. And not to be too defeatist, dare I say, often futile, but even in small organizations, the organization size isn't the issue. Because I've seen in small organizations, there's problems with this as well. But I don't know, is the solution that we define a job description or a role around that? Maybe, probably not, because it means more than that, right? There's going to be some business processes and business practices that may have to change. There may be bigger changes than just putting someone in place, hiring someone to do that job. I see that approach taken a lot, and rarely as effectively as possible. And I see a lot of people leave those positions because they get in there and go, sheesh, I can't make changes to squat. And here's what's needed, and I'm pushing uphill all the time, and does anybody even want me here? They respond to me as though they don't. You know, do I want to have everything be a battle? It puts them in a real adversarial spot that just I've never seen work out. So just hiring somebody and saying, you're in charge of vigilance and intervention. Nope, that's not going to happen. That has to be with everybody, all through all levels of the organization needs to be enabled to take on that kind of role or make those kinds of applications, even if it's not their full-time role. But it, like I said, it's involved. It gets into decision-making process and at all levels. So that's really something maybe has to be culturally, right? Maybe it has to be, I don't know, there's got to be whatever drives effective change in your organization. That's where it needs to happen. And that's going to differ one organization to the next. So interesting. I love it. I love that it's not cookie cutter, because that's cool. Because people who like to adapt and learn, they're the ones who succeed, not the ones who like to just regurgitate and reimplement the same approach somewhere else. So anyways, it's been good for me. Hopefully it's been good information and good discussion for you. And we'll talk to you next time.